science enthusiasts. I'm your host, Jason Zukowski. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, but you probably know our dogs, Bunsen and Beaker. They're the science dogs on social media. This show takes what's best from their account, the curiosity and fun found there, and swirls it into podcast form. Every week, we're going to take some deep dive into an area of science and look at the research that's going on with our pets. We'll also have an expert guest who will enthrall you with their area of knowledge. This is the Science Podcast. Hello. Thanks for tuning into our show this week. It's going to be a good one. Oh, man, Chris and I are so busy. It's time to go back to school. The summer's over. We are in our classrooms prepping for the students. Hopefully our coronavirus numbers stay down. The modeling doesn't show that. That's going to be a whole nother thing I'll be talking about in a couple weeks, probably. And I'm in something called con crunch right now, which means I'm super busy trying to get our costumes ready for the Calgary Comic Con. Cause, as I mentioned, I was pretty honored to be asked to be a cosplay guest, and I got to get some of that stuff ready. It's not quite finished and I'm down to the wire. Anyways, speaking of the podcast this week, in science news, we're going to have a chat about sports psychology, about how coronavirus and not having fans in the stadium has affected sport. It's kind of interesting. In pet science, we're going to look at a study that paired dog puppies versus wolf puppies and some of the differences. It's similar to what Dr. Emily Bray talked about a couple weeks ago. And our expert guest is Dagmar Dervé-Duvin, who is a researcher of the archer fish. And man, this is such a good interview. I can't wait to share it with you guys. Hey dogs, where does Legolas the elven archer love to shop? At Target. Okay, this is so bad. All right, on with the show, because there's no time like science time. All right, this week in science news, we're going to talk a little bit of sports psychology. When I was younger, I watched sports all of the time. I loved watching basketball. I was a huge Michael Jordan fan. Huge Michael Jordan fan. And as I've gotten older and I've gotten busier, watching sports on television is something that I've had to kind of say goodbye to. I don't really watch sports anymore, but I definitely don't begrudge people that love sports. It's exciting, especially if you played the sport, to marvel at how the athletes can move their bodies and do the feats that we only dream of as mere mortals. Or at least that's what I thought about Michael Jordan as a kid playing basketball in Canada. So the article this week is about the effect of not having fans in home, in stadiums, to cheer on their team. This is from August 19th in Frontiers in Sports and Active Living. The two sports psychologists, Richland and Michael Leitner from the University of Salzburg, they looked at hundreds of games for the 2018-2019 season, and then quote-unquote ghost games, which were games played without and much of an audience or any audience, hundreds of those games played during the shutdown of 2019 and 2020. Now, this was football, aka soccer, right? So I've gotten in the habit of calling soccer football. It's very confusing because in Canada, soccer is called soccer. It's not called football. We have football. And of course, you know, football doesn't make any sense because you don't normally use your foot with American football. You like run with the ball. You sometimes kick the ball. You sometimes throw the ball. Anyways, that's a whole comedy bit I've seen comedians do. Now, the countries they looked at for this were European. So Spain, England, Germany, Russia, Turkey, Austria. So it was football in Europe, basically. The stands were mostly empty for the home games. Home teams had a win percentage decrease by 8%, went from home teams winning just about 50% of the time to about 40% of the time. And the loss rate at home increased by the same amount, 8%, of course. I think you can have some ties in football/soccer. I don't know. One extra thing they looked at was how ghost games affected referees and how referees were calling games. Without fans, foul calls against home teams increased by 26%. Well, calls against away teams increased by only 3%. The referees were not as generous with their calls to the home team. This is the main draw for the win-loss. This is the conclusion, is there's a whole bunch of other variables at play, but because of the extra foul calls, that is the predominant factor as to why the home team had a greater loss percentage. And the psychology comes from, are the referees pressured to make calls in favor of the home team when you're at home? Is that why sports teams have home field advantage? In other studies, it appears to also be true that the home team gets a little less calls against them than the opposition team. But the reason as to why that was kind of unclear. Do the referees just like their home team more? Referees in a lot of places don't necessarily come from the home team's home. They travel around with the league to maintain their impartial ability to call games. But the pressure of screaming fans and yelling fans may, and in this case it appears it does, affect the referee's judgment in giving calls in sport. Now, the whole why that happens, that's up to some other sports psychologists to figure that out. This was just a big meta-analysis of games before the lockdown and after. There's the definite effect of a loss of home field advantage and a definite increase in the amount of penalties called against the home team without the pressure of a crowd. That's science news for this week. This week in Pet Science, it's another one of those dog versus wolf study. And this is a great one from July that was done at Duke University. It's similar to the setup that Dr. Emily Bray talked about a couple weeks ago with an interesting twist. The big thing was determining if little puppies, dog puppies, just get humans more than wolf puppies. So how did they go about determining this? How did they go about determining if a little dog gets you more than a wolf puppy? Well, you have to round up a bunch of dog puppies and a bunch of wolf puppies. 44 dog puppies, 37 wolf puppies. And they were young, between 5 and 18 weeks old. To determine if the wolf puppies weren't a dog-wolf hybrid, they were genetically tested to make sure they were wolf, because you didn't want any mixes in there to throw off the study, I guess. And the scientists tested the ability of the dog puppies and the wolf puppies to just understand a couple human cues. The results were amazing. With no training, the dog puppies as young as 8 weeks old understood what was going on in the study at a far higher rate than the wolf puppies. The wolf puppies really, really got confused. So what did they get confused about? How did they get tested? In one of the tests, the researchers put a treat in one of two bowls and then gave the puppies, wolf or dog puppies, a clue to help them find the food. Now, in some of the trials, the clue was a point. In some of the trials, it was a look. They would just look in the directions. Now, the coolest one was the human would place a block next to the bowl that had the treat. So it was like the human did something like marking the bowl. And this is where the puppies really, really clobbered the wolf puppies. Like just doing that thing, the puppies were like, oh, that's something the human did that's different. I'm going to go check that bowl out. And overwhelmingly, the puppies did better than the wolf puppies. The wolf puppies really struggled with that task. And the wolf puppies also struggled with the pointing task and the looking task. The conclusion is dogs being raised with humans for so many generations are more in tune with our clues. It doesn't mean that wolves are dumb, and the study makes a good point of that, is that they ran the wolf puppies and the puppy puppies through other tests like problem solving that doesn't rely on human cues or their ability to move their body and solve problems with their body that way. And the wolf puppies did great. They're highly intelligent, as intelligent or more so in some areas than little puppies, than dog puppies. But when you throw a human into the mix, our bond with those dogs through thousands and thousands of years of selective breeding has really changed their brain to just intuitively kind of get us. And I love that. That makes me feel, like, gives me warm fuzzies inside. That's Pet Science for this week.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Science Podcast this week. The Science Podcast is always going to be free to download, but if you want to support the show, there's a couple things you can do. The first one is sign up on our Patreon page, patreon.com/BunsenBurner. There's multiple tiers of support. We have a ton of fun with the patron group. You get to be on the podcast. You get postcards from Bunsen and Beaker. You get swag. You get early pictures. You get a whole bunch of awesome stuff. So check it out. The lowest tier is only $5 a month. The other way you could support the show is checking out our merch shop. Our merch shop is hilarious. It's got all of these adorable cartoons of Bunsen and Beaker. We keep producing more. I just want to thank the people that have supported the show that way. We're really, really proud of our merch shop because the merch, the clothes, is really high quality. The colors are vibrant, and we come up with some really fun designs all the time. So check it out. That's at BunsenBurnerBMD.com. Thanks, everybody. On to the interview.
It's time for Ask an Expert, and I have Dagmar Dervé-Duven with me today. How are you doing today, Dagmar?
Very good. Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
I'm excited to talk to you. Where, just for, you know, reference sake, where are you calling into the podcast from?
I'm in St. Andrews in Scotland.
Scotland. Now, are you from Scotland originally?
No, I'm from the Netherlands.
Did you, okay, born and raised in the Netherlands, or were, are you one of the people that have hopped around the planet?
I'm one of those planet hoppers, yeah.
Oh, okay. All right, cool. Is Netherlands like your home? Would you say it's your home, or is it kind of a confusing thing?
It gets confusing. I'd say it's definitely my, like, home country.
Okay.
You drop me in Amsterdam, I'll find my way around, you know.
Okay.
Like it's yeah.
Gotcha.
It's mostly home.
And the other question we've been asking guests for really a year and a half is you and your family doing okay with coronavirus?
Yeah, we're doing pretty good. My family's also a bit all over the place. But, you know, my parents are fully vaccinated, and me and my brothers all have at least one vaccine now. And Scotland, numbers aren't going so well. And, you know, I have my own opinions on certain members of the government who are opening things up too quickly, in my opinion. But in St. Andrews itself, things are going pretty well. Because it's such a small place.
Mm.
So,
yeah. So just for reference sake for everybody, because I'm not sure when this podcast will come out. Usually they're banked a bit. It's July.
Yes.
We're talking kind of mid-July.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of this we'll keep, but Alberta, where I live in Canada, is fully open.
Mm.
And it is kind of worrisome. The good thing is our vaccination rates are approaching first dose 76%, and they're hoping the second dose will be about at that in September.
Okay.
No, I don't know if that's enough for herd immunity, but I know there are definitely worrying trends.
Yeah.
Like in the United States, for example, the country south of us, they had 40-some thousand cases yesterday alone.
Oh, God, yeah.
And they're in their states that have low vaccination rates.
Yeah, I think the whole country here, the whole UK is close to 40,000 as well. And for those in the UK who might be listening, we're recording this 2 days before the mask mandate drops in England. So thankfully not in Scotland. Scotland, everyone still is going to have to mask up, which I'm happy about. But
it's so interesting because interesting and scary and sad and in some places hopeful. I've talked to guests about this for like a year and a half, and literally like 3 or 4 weeks ago, everybody was really positive. Like things are looking good. And then depending on where you are in the world, it is changing quickly. So,
yep.
Yeah.
Hmm. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, let's talk about you, Dagmar. can you tell everybody a little bit about what you're doing right now in science, the kind of like where you are in your career and your studies?
Yeah, absolutely.
Go for it.
So I'm second year, just going into my third year of my PhD at the University of St. Andrews. And I am researching social learning and imitation in archerfish. And
you're working on your PhD.
Yep.
What got you into science? Like that's an ex- Congratulations for one. I haven't gone back past my two undergrad degrees, but it's like people go on to their masters and PhDs. I got such respect for. You have to have a lot of drive, but you also have to have a lot of passion for science.
Yeah.
What was it for you?
It's just kind of always been what I wanted to do. I think I remember when I was like 4 or 5, my life's ambition was to move to Canada and become an Arctic biologist.
Oh,
I don't think I knew what Arctic biologists did at the time. I think I just really liked seals and like there must be seals in the Arctic or something. It's always, you know, stuck around since then. And I had a long time where I thought I wanted to be a vet, did some internships with vets, like wildlife rehabilitation work. And then I didn't get into vet school for college. So I just went and did biology instead because, you know, it was the next best thing. And almost, I think within my first year of university, I realized that I'd made the right decision not going to vet school because it gets a bit repetitive, perhaps. Mm. Not saying like, you know, vets are boring or anything, but for me, I don't think it would have been the right career. And science is just, there's so much that changes constantly, and there's always something new that you can, you know, discover or explore or question. And there's so many different topics that you could focus on. And that was something I really, really enjoyed, you know, not having to box myself into one specific idea or topic. So I did a lot of research assistant work as an undergrad. I helped a PhD student who was studying human cooperation. So instead of applying psychological concepts to how humans interact with each other, she applied more like evolutionary biology and ecology concepts to human interaction, which was really interesting because, you know, we are animals and we do things quite similarly to other animals as well. And then I helped on a project here in Scotland where I spent a few summers just driving around like the whole country, essentially looking for blue tits. And it was like big transect and we were recording like how many chicks they'd have and how many eggs and, you know, how tall their nests were and everything to kind of mimic what things might look like if the climate were to change. Oh. Because there's like a gradient of how like birds further south obviously start nesting earlier and so forth, and they change they just change the way they do things with their offspring. So we looked at, you know, how are the birds further south doing compared to the ones further north, and how are like the dynamics changing in relation to when they're breeding because caterpillars come at different times, and that was so much fun and really got me very into ecology, which is what I do now. I just said I really, really love working with animals still. So, it's part of the passion is just getting to be around animals.
Gotcha. So a little bit maybe of that interest in veterinary studies stayed with you, but just totally different path that you took.
Yes. More trying to like discover new things about animals rather than trying to fix them.
Right. And everybody has different passions, skill sets, and things that they're really interested in. I've said this before on the podcast. I was always the one in university that people were like, can you present this information? Because that's what you're good at. And I'm like, I'll be the talker. And that's probably why I'm a high school teacher, right? Because teaching has a lot of talking and presenting. Yep. And I was very happy when my group did like the really, really nitty gritty research stuff. That is so, again, that's not my skill set. And I have such respect for people that are good at that.
Yeah, it takes different kinds of people. I like both of those things.
Oh, good.
So
you're dual classed.
Yes. Yeah.
So let's move on to archer fish. That's what you're studying right now. Okay.
Yep.
So this is kind of a big question. Like, why are you studying them?
So it's kind of an accident that I ended up studying them, but I had a brief interlude during my master's where I ended up studying plant ecology, which was also really fun, but I really wanted to go back to animals and I knew I wanted to do a PhD. So I was just looking for, you know, what projects are available. and I saw a project advertised in my same department in St. Andrews by the guy whose office door I sat next to in the department. So I just went, like, knocked on his door, like, hey, can you tell me about these fish I've never heard of?
Yeah, that's amazing.
And he did. And they, like, took me to the lab. They showed me the fish. And I just kind of fell in love with them immediately because they're not like any other kind of animal I've ever heard of or dealt with. Archer fish, for those who don't know, which, you know, might be a lot of people, are these tropical fish that spit jets of water at insects that are above the water surface. That's one of their primary hunting methods.
They have a water gun mouth.
And they have water gun mouths, exactly. And they're the only animal that actually uses a water projectile like that. You know, there's other animals that use fluid projectiles, but it tends to be like bodily fluids. And the fish just, you know, take a gulp of water essentially and then compress their gills and spit the water out through their mouths instead of through their gills, which is just really, really cool. And they have these, because they have this incredible behavior and because they're not social, but they're very aware of the other fish around them. So they have like this social, this understanding of the sociality that is happening. They make really good subjects for studying how these kinds of animals can learn things socially and from each other. And most of the research that's been done on social learning started off, you know, we used to think only humans can do this. People started looking at apes, chimpanzees, and going, oh, well, they're doing, you know, similar things. And now you hear about, like, crows that do similar things and stuff.
Yeah. But
fish almost never get brought up.
No, they don't.
And, you know, it's we like to think, you know, this animal looks like us or it acts a bit like us, so it must be as capable as us. Mm. And that just doesn't have to be true. And I think it's so important to study archerfish, and I love studying them so much because they kind of prove that. They look nothing like humans. They act nothing like humans. Their brains are the size of a grain of rice. you know, we have so little in common with them on the surface, but deep down, they actually share a lot of like characteristics humans do when it comes to things like learning.
Huh. You know, I'm so dense. Now I just get why they're called archer fish. like bow and arrow.
yep. No, okay. I just give them tiny bows and arrows as well.
Just a couple follow-up questions. Okay, so the first one, just for context for people who maybe, I probably should have led with this, but you did a good job of explaining what the archerfish is. Where do they live in the world? Like, where can you, I've never seen one. They obviously don't live where I live.
No, they only live in Scotland in the lab because they're tropical. So they
okay, very, oh, very good answer.
Not too well in the waters in Scotland. There's multiple species. Most of them are freshwater, though they can live in brackish water as well. And they're found, and you know, the species distribution varies, but they're found from Sri Lanka and India all the way across Southeast Asia, up towards China, and down in Australia as well. So they have a very wide range.
Oh, wow. Would they be considered more a generalist then, hey, than a specialist with their broad range of where they could live? I don't know. That could be that's not a very good question. I don't know.
I'm not sure. There hasn't been that much research done on them in the wild.
Oh, okay.
But they can, so there are species that are more adapted to brackish water, but they can very easily be adjusted to live in fresh water. And you know, all the different species do vary, and I'm not 100% sure on which, how they're distributed specifically. Although there doesn't seem to be that many differences between the species, apart from like their patterns that are on them. Just these silver fish with these black markings. And it's mostly the markings that seem to vary between species. So they could well be generalists. They like mangrove forests, though, because there's lots of overhanging branches with insects on them that they can shoot at.
So do they have a specific insect they like to eat? Or are they opportunistic? They'll just like eat any insect that's kind of like within range of its spit.
They will eat literally anything. The tanks we have them in the lab, they have plastic plants in there, and some of them were getting a bit old and a leaf came off one and the fish tried to eat that too. anything that fits in their mouth, they will try to eat.
Now, any insect, really. I'm just so fascinated. when they're in the lab, do they do yeah. their do they hunt like they do in nature, or do you feed them fish food?
We feed them fish food, but sometimes they get crickets or flies. We have a cricket lab across the way from our fish lab, so if they've got like crickets left over that they can't use for their whatever experiments they do, we get them. The fish love that. But we do when we feed them, we do try to get them to spit for the food. So I get spat at a lot in the lab
because really
I'm like little bit. They know that when I show up, they're all like coming near where I am, and I'm like counting out like little pellets of fish food in my hand, and they're all like staring at my hand. And then I'll hold it above the tank, and I'll get wet because they've got good aim.
Oh, that was going to be my other question, is like, how accurate is their spit jet?
So if they're good at spitting, they're very good. They can shoot water for up to 2 meters as well. So they've got incredible 2 meters.
Range.
Wow. Yep. They've hit the ceiling in the lab before. I'm walking past, I'm not fast enough. And they'll spit in my face as I'm walking past. They're like the tiniest gap in the top of the tank. Some of the fish seem to have like a little, like a disability almost, where their mouth isn't the right shape. So they end up spitting behind them instead of where they're actually trying to shoot. Which is a bit sad, but the spitting is only part of their hunting mechanism. So in the wild, those fish definitely could still survive.
Oh, okay. You know, I'm wondering if they shouldn't be called archer fish instead of they should be called sniper fish.
That'd be cool. I'm okay with that.
So you mentioned that you're studying, this is all kind of like their physiology, but for people that don't know anything about archerfish, I think this is a really good kind of framework.
Yep.
But now you're into studying their interaction socially.
Yeah.
Is there some interesting things you've discovered or that other people have discovered that you could tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or about archerfish in general, even.
Oh, I've got so many cool archerfish facts. But about their like social learning. So the most complex, usually, and complex is a controversial phrase in behavioral ecology, but the most like difficult type of social learning for animals seems to be imitation. So like directly mirroring what another individual does. And humans and apes have these things called mirror neurons, which are thought to be involved in this, that they trigger when, you know, if I were to wave my hand at you, the mirror neuron would trigger in you that it would tell you, oh, if we do this exact same motion, we'll copy what she's currently doing to us. So that's what those mirror neurons do. And fish don't have those. But there is some limited evidence that archerfish might be able to imitate anyways, from a lab in Germany. And it was more like an anecdotal mention in a study that tried to get these fish to shoot accurately at a moving target, which you can train them, and then they get really good at that. And they kind of predict where the target's going to move to, so they can hit it. But then they trained this one fish, and that fish was quite aggressive and wouldn't let the other fish attempt. So when they eventually tested the other fish that had been in the tank, they were just as good as hitting the moving target as the trained fish was. So the whole training phase the trained fish had to go through was like erased for the other fish, which suggests that these fish learn to imitate like the methods that the trained fish was using without actually trying it themselves. But because that was very anecdotal, that's basically, I'm going to try to recreate that kind of effect to see if these fish can learn to copy this specific hunting behaviors from each other. Because if they can, that just kind of proves that, you know, mirror neurons aren't required for imitation, and it might not be as complex as people currently think. Experiments.
That would be crazy, right?
It would like, be that's, insane.
That's a big deal, right? Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of, you know, like, I made a joke earlier this week as well, that every time I'm on a podcast, I end up accidentally starting a fight with some other kind of scientists. And it's usually the primatologists, because a lot of people think, well, apes can do this because we're so closely related to them, evolutionarily speaking. And I just disagree. I don't have proof yet, but I really want to find some.
Monkey see, monkey do.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, archerfish see, archerfish do.
Right.
And that okay, is.
Wait. Dakmar, I have a question. Yeah. Are you training the fish right now to hit a moving target? Are you kind of replicating that experiment, or is it something else that you're going to be working on?
I want to get a moving target, but it's a bit complicated the way that I'm trying to set it up, because I'm using the lab that did this in Germany. They did it in 2006, and they've lost, I think, the notes of how they created the moving targets. So I have to make one myself, which is very difficult. I'm not an engineer. So what we have at the moment is an undergraduate student helped us and created a automatic fish feeder that is drops food in the tank when the fish spits at a motion sensor. So the fish spits, the motion sensor's triggered, and then like this Lego structure moves and drops a piece of food in the tank.
Yeah. Did they make it from Lego Mindstorms?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant.
It's and a Raspberry Pi.
yeah.
So I want to, you know, make it a little bit more snazzy looking, you know, be able to put more food in it. And then I'm going to attach a fake target to it as well. So an identical sensor, but just not hooked up to the machine. And train one fish to hit the actual target. They'll be distinguished, you know, by like shape or something, and then see if the other fish in the tank can figure out how to do that too. And it's combining research done by the team in Germany and by the previous PhD student who worked with the archerfish in my lab, who found that you can definitely teach archerfish to, you know, shoot at a specific target compared to another one, but... And he had fish in separate tanks, and that makes observing a little bit more difficult because they're looking through two barriers of glass as well. So the neighboring fish weren't that interested in what the shooter was doing. But if I have them in the same tank, it'll be more interesting, I think, for the fish to observe because, you know, they'll be able to get the food as well if they could try. And they'll be directly interacting with that fish that's doing the shooting.
So you train up some snipers.
Yes.
And then you put the like unskilled or whatever that you're the fish that didn't get the training.
Yep.
And the hope is that they'll watch what's going on and they'll be like, oh, I can just do this. And without any training, they'll figure it out.
Exactly. Yeah. So wow. I'll test all of the untrained recruits individually after a while. Yeah. We call them naive individuals in science, but recruits is way more fun.
I like that, naive individuals. I should have said that before. I knew that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's called diffusion learning, that process of just, you know, being around an individual and then learning how to do the thing that individual's doing.
People are going to get upset with me if I don't ask. Do you name the fish? Like the ones that are really, really good? Like, do you name that one Legolas or, you know, Hawkeye or something like that?
So I do name the fish, but my best shooter is actually called Mr. Grumpy. their mouths, because of the shape of their mouths, it's quite upturned. They have this like kind of bottom. It's not a lip, but it looks a bit like a lip that sticks out. So their mouth's always downturned. They always look a bit angry and sad. And the one who's on his own, my best shooter has to be on his own because he's such a bully. He, you know, kind of tries to kill the other fish. So I just started calling him Mr. Grumpy because he was the easiest to recognize because the other fish are all in larger tanks and there's multiple in there. But all the other fish do have names. And I did name all of them after archers from history and fiction. So I do have a Legolas.
Oh, you do?
I used to have a Hawkeye, but he now lives at the local aquarium instead. He's retired.
Right. What is William Tell? I'm just trying to think of Robin Hood. Is that one?
Robin Hood, William Tell. I had a whole tank of Greek mythology names.
Oh, right.
Artemis or something. And Artemis, yeah. and a Lord of the Rings tank. So Legolas, Bard, Kili, and Tauriel. As kind of dislike the Hobbit movies, I needed another name.
Yeah, you need Bard in there. He took down Smaug. So
he did. He's fantastic. and then yeah, just a sort of tank. I had a Susan Pevensie from Narnia, William Tell, a Hawkeye, Actually, I had two Hawkeyes because it was Clint Barton and Kate Bishop.
Oh, wow. So you, this is great. You you know what you're talking about then.
A little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cute. That's great. People, you've just got street cred with all of like the comic book nerds that listen to the podcast.
Hell yes.
That's great. I've totally derailed our scientific conversation into something silly.
That's good.
So in the future, in the future with Archer Fish, what are some things you're dreaming up, or is this experiment right now all-consuming?
At the moment, it's a bit all-consuming, but one day I would love to be able to figure out some of the neurology behind the shooting and behind, basically, they're like group dynamics, because Archer Fish are very aware of when other Archer Fish are watching them, because they live, they're not social, they're facultatively social, which is a phrase I've heard come up before on the podcast. So they're not, they don't require other fish to be around them, but they just, the places they live, there will be other Archer Fish. And especially in the lab, they're in tanks and, you know, at least four or five individuals per tank. And they don't shoot as quickly when they know another fish is watching them. So they can understand what that other fish can see. And if they know if they shoot and the food falls, that other fish is going to try to get it too. So that's really like well established. But then I've just finished analysis for a project where we had groups of three and five fish. And I went through hours and hours of footage of like videos of these fish and recorded which fish was shooting at the food and which fish was nearby and how far away it was and things like that. And there was no difference in how long it took these fish to aim. There was a difference in how long it took each fish to aim in the different group sizes. So in groups of, let me get this the right way around. In groups of five, they spend less time aiming at the food than in groups of three. But the success with which they shot the food didn't change. So even if they spent less time aiming, they'd still hit it dead on. Which is really interesting, because at the same time, they're clearly aware that there's more fish around them when they're spending less time aiming. And I think that's because, you know, they maybe if there's fewer fish, they don't want the other fish to realize what's going on.
Oh, that's so interesting. Like there's more distractions with more fish, so there's less chance those fish are watching them individually.
Yes. Yes. Or there's more chance someone else will try to get the food first. Oh. So they have to be faster. We're not entirely sure why this is. So I'd love to investigate that more and see if, you know, maybe there's something else. Like in the wild, maybe there's something that would explain this, but we just don't know. So really dream for Archer Fish would be going into the wild and observing them there and just finding out if they, you know, do the same things they do in the lab.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's crazy. Here, and I was just, when I was saying that to you, that I was like putting human like instinct on these fish. And, yeah. And also that's interesting. Archer Fish may be more similar in how they have social structures to us than we thought.
It's definitely possible. I mean, I can't say that definitely, but there's other parts of Archer Fish, just like the way their brain processes things when they search for prey, you know, like scanning the environment, it's the exact same way humans search for something. So they remember where they've already looked, and they kind of have, when they see the thing they're looking for, it kind of pops out from the background. So if you picture like you're doing like a Where's Waldo thing, you know, when you see him, he kind of stands out and you remember that he's there. And Archer Fish do the exact same thing, just with insects and forests.
With their little tiny piece of rice-sized brain.
Absolutely, yep.
That's wild.
Huh. Yep. And they're doing all that while they're looking through a barrier of water into the air. They're somehow dealing with the refraction as well, because they know where to aim, even though what they're looking at isn't actually in the place where it looks to be.
They have to correct for sense. Physics.
Yes. Yeah, I use this example a lot, but if you were to try to do the same thing Archer Fish do, you'd have to be at the bottom of a pool with a super soaker and then try to hit a fly that's like in the air. And wherever you think the fly is, it's actually a little bit like to one side or further away or something because you're looking through those barriers.
Well, and it depends on your different. And it depends on, doesn't it depend on your angle to the surface too?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Archer fish, my goodness. It's crazy.
Archerfish do spit from right below the surface. But they do definitely seem to like angle themselves what might be the optimal like direction, but their eyes are also so complex. And for their tiny, tiny brains, it's just so cool that they can do all that stuff. Because we couldn't do that.
No, like, well, for one, I've tried to shoot a super soaker in a pool under the water, and it doesn't work. No. It doesn't work at all.
And if you tried to spit, you'd only get very, very minimum height.
Yes, exactly. And if you tried to spit in a pool, I was a former lifeguard, I would give you heck, you'd be in big trouble.
Yes, yes. And it's a bit gross.
It is. So, okay, we're going to move on past Archer Fish to come some of our standard questions we ask on the podcast. Yep. And the one we ask everybody to share is a pet story. Do you have a pet story you could share with us?
Absolutely. I actually had to check with my family if this was something that actually happened or if it was like a weird dream I had. But they've confirmed this was real. It's a crazy story. So I've had numerous pets over the years. I've had cats, hamsters, slightly feral guinea pigs, fish. But when I was a teenager, I had a dog, a black Labrador. Her name was Pippa, and she was the absolute best thing ever.
Aww.
And we lived in Kenya at the time because of my parents' work. And Pippa just loved like trying to find every animal that she could eat. We had a big garden. She'd like go and forage, you know, gardeners would find a mole and Pippa would be there like, oh yes, let me taste this. And we'd have the rainy season and all the male termites would come flying into the house and Pippa would just put her face down on the ground and like suck them all up like a Hoover. And have lots of protein. And chameleons, she'd go find chameleons in the garden and I never saw her eat them or kill them, but she just kind of put them in her mouth like, I know you're not tasty, but I kind of want to try. And the worst ones, the ones she hated the most, were the geckos, which they'd be on the walls outside and inside the house. And they knew big, scary, yapping thing that's constantly barking at us. So they stayed high up on the walls and she could never get to them. No.
Oh, no.
So we were a bit used to her barking at the walls because you're like, oh, it's a gecko. Okay. Until one day when we were in the dining room, whole family having dinner, Pippa just, you know, kind of snoozing on the side. And so she got up and started barking at the wall in a way that was slightly different from normal. And we were like, oh, that can't just be a gecko. And we looked over and there was a black mamba coming out of the ceiling.
Oh no.
Yes. Oh no. And I want to preface the next part by saying, I love snakes. I don't think people should kill snakes. But if there's a black mamba coming out of the ceiling towards you and your children, I'm going to condone my father's actions at the time, which is that he grabbed a machete and cut its head off. The dog was going insane. And we were all there like, oh, God, like, what do you even do when a very poisonous snake comes out of your ceiling?
You got seconds to act, I guess.
Exactly, eh? Yeah. And, you know, my dad, for his job, he's quite cool under pressure. My mom, too, but I think my dad was closer to the machete. But this is why I had to double check that this was a real story, because it's such a ridiculous thing to have happen. And, you know, we knew there were snakes in the garden, and, if you know, we'd not go near them if we knew they were in a certain location, but to have one come out of the ceiling was just something else. And it took a few years before I realized that's not a normal experience. And I think about it a lot now because, you know, if it hadn't happened at that moment in the room where Pippa had been, that snake could have come out of any other ceiling at any point during the night and, you know, hidden somewhere in the house or bitten me or someone in my family. I don't know what they do. So I'm just, I do miss Pippa a lot. And I always think about, you know, that moment. She kind of saved us all by warning us that this very dangerous creature was coming into the room.
What a good girl.
She was a very good girl. She was very, very good.
I can't imagine Beaker in Kenya with like geckos. Oh my goodness. She would be just like Pippa.
Just too excited.
Yeah. She'd be like, oh my goodness, these things are everywhere to try and catch.
Yeah. There were giant, like, rodents of unusual size type rats as well. I mean, smaller than that, but very, very large rats. And Pippa would definitely catch those and eat them, bury them, and then dig them up again a few months later when they'd ripened and eat the rest.
Oh, gross.
Moose legs.
Well, okay, that's an amazing story. Thank you for sharing your pet story.
I do want to say, you know, if you find a snake somewhere, don't just kill it, please. Putting this out there, just leave him alone. If they're actively threatening you, use your best judgment. Don't go out and kill snakes.
I think people will be, have some understanding there.
Yes. Okay, very good. Very good.
It's the same thing as like coyotes in Alberta.
Yeah.
Right? You leave them alone, but if they're threatening you,
then it's
or they're
else.
Somehow in your house. It's going to be a different story.
If a coyote comes out of your ceiling.
If a coyote comes. Exactly.
That's a funny sight.
All right. Thanks for sharing your pet story.
Yes, absolutely.
The other question we always ask guests for is a super fact. And a super fact is something that you know that kind of blows people's mind. I don't know if you've already given away your super fact. You've said so many amazing things about archerfish. But do you have a super fact left for us?
Usually what I tell people is about the archerfish eyes or the archerfish searching, but I do actually have one more archerfish fact, which people are also always astonished by. And again, brain the size of a grain of rice. Keep that in mind. And then picture that I threw two tennis balls in your direction, but like kind of one to the left and one to the right. You had to make a decision which one you're going to catch. So that happens in a split second, probably. Or you just stand there in a panic and go, oh my God, why is she throwing things at me? But when you throw two pieces of food into an archerfish tank, but in opposite directions, within milliseconds, the fish has calculated where each piece of food is going to land, which one is going to land closer, bent its body into like a C shape to very quickly take off in the direction of the closer piece of food, and it will reach the food the moment it hits the water. And that is just something that is so impressive to me, because those are the kinds of decisions that like pro athletes train their whole career to be able to do things like that, to be able to run to the exact spot where someone's throwing a football or whatever.
Yeah, Dennis Rodman with rebounding for the Chicago Bulls. Like, he practiced hours just the trajectory of weird ball bounces.
Yep. And these fish are making those kinds of decisions so quickly. It's just blows my mind. Every time I throw a piece of food into a fish tank in the lab, and they're immediately there. Because they know where it's coming, and they kind of do all that complex math in their head without realizing it's math or possibly even thinking about it very much. And I just think that's the coolest adaptation ever for something that's so small and so like unassuming looking, really.
Do you know how agonizing it is to like pick which drive-through to get through first in Tim Hortons to which one's faster? I wish I could think like an archerfish. And for people not from Canada, Tim Hortons is like the coffee donut chain that is ubiquitously Canadian. So sorry for that reference. I'm not sure what would that be in the States. Dunkin' Donuts,
I think. Yeah.
I don't know what you have in Scotland. Sorry.
I think we've got Krispy Kremes.
Krispy Kremes.
I haven't seen one in a while. We don't have those in St. Andrews. Here we have very little. We have a nice beach.
Oh well, that we don't have that.
Very nice beach.
All right. Well, that is a super fact. It makes me super. If a super fact makes me super think, then that's double right there.
Yes, so. Yes. These fish are smarter than you, probably.
There are a lot of things smarter than me. I was going to say, when you were talking about, you know, they only have this, you know, they're different at the start of the podcast. You're talking about how, you know, they're very different than humans. They only have a brain the size of a grain of rice. And I was like, you know what? The last couple of years of this pandemic, I think there's a lot of people out there with a brain the size of a grain of rice, but maybe you know what, that's archerfish need way more credit than that. So
absolutely, I think maybe they just have better like neural connections or something.
Yeah,
I don't know anything about neurology.
Okay, well, that's great. I'm just trying to think of a good segue. The last question that we ask people on the podcast is one that lets our audience get to know you a little bit more personally than your just your area of science. And it's a fun one. It's something that's your area of passion outside of your work.
Yeah.
And we were talking before the interview, and I don't know where this is going to go, but I think it's going to be fun. You wanted to talk about hats, like hats you put on your head.
Yes.
Go for it. I'm excited.
Yeah. No, I love hats. I love wearing hats. I love buying hats. I love looking at hats. But it's not just as simple as, you know, them being something to put on your head for me. I have something called trichotillomania, which is a body-focused repetitive disorder, which is a very complicated and lengthy way and scientific way of saying that when I'm not paying attention to my hands, I pull at my hair. And I've had this for a number of years. I had it when I was a small child as well. It went away and then it came back. And at times it's been so bad that like I've had bald spots from it. And it really, really affected my self-esteem a lot. And then I was in a shop one day with my mom and she found this red beanie. And she's like, oh, this would look really good on you. You should, you know, I'm going to buy this for you. And that was kind of the moment where I realized when I'm wearing a hat, I cannot pull up my hair. And my hair started to recover and grow back. And I started buying more hats because you can't always wear a red beanie. Sometimes it's too hot. Sometimes the color doesn't match. And now I should have done an inventory right before, but I think I have about 15 hats in my closet where I'm currently sitting. And I've got a hat with fish on it. I've got fedora style hats, bowler hats, like this vintage red like hat with a buckle on it. And it's amazing. And I wear them a lot. People on Twitter, where I do most of my outreach work, have kind of started to get to know me as like the hat person, as well as the archerfish person. I have my own hashtag, hashtag Hatmar. And just, you know, starting to wear hats and becoming more confident in myself and more at ease with this disorder that I have has allowed me to talk about it more. And in turn, that has been able to help other people. So I've made friends on the internet because I was willing to speak out about this issue that I have. And trichotillomania is suspected to affect maybe 1 in 10 people in the world at some point in their life. So it's something people don't really know about, but it's something that affects a lot of people too. And just being able to speak about it and then to hear from other people who were just as embarrassed as me, who were just as affected as I was. And to hear from them that, you know, I've kind of done something to give them maybe a little bit of confidence. It's just such a nice thing that I've been able to do because I discovered hats. And, you know, people don't wear hats often enough. I think we should go back to the 1920s when everyone wore fancy hats all the time. Mm-hmm. That's my ambition in life, is to have like a hat for every outfit. But in the meantime, I'll stick with what I've got and just keep talking about this stuff because it's been a big part of my life and it's a big part of other people's lives too.
I love that you had the courage to share that and and you know, it's a serious situation, but you having a hashtag Hatmar
yes.
And just having fun with it. And owning it and turning it into something that can be positive for other people. That's kudos to you.
Thank you. Yeah. I've not like fully recovered from this. I still pull at my hair sometimes, but it's gotten a lot better. And especially just speaking about it has made it a lot better. Because, you know, you get into cycles like, oh, well, I feel guilty because I keep doing this thing, but then doing the thing makes me feel more guilty and you just get kind of caught up in it. So being able to talk about it really, really, really helps. So anyone else out there who's, you know, hearing this and thinks, oh, well, I've got that same kind of problem. It's embarrassing, but you're not the only one. And ultimately, if people tell you, you know, oh, that's so gross or whatever. Who cares? They don't know what you're dealing with. So just ignore them and, you know, be yourself and maybe buy a hat.
Put on a stylish hat.
Put on a stylish hat.
You know what, Dakmar, I would love, if you send me your address, I would love to send you a toque. We have toques in our merch store.
Oh my God.
I would love to send you our Everything is Possum Bunsen toque.
Oh my God, I would love that so much.
Yeah, I would, just for your courage speaking out about that, I think everybody needs a nice Canadian toque.
I don't have one.
So, yet, you know, so. It gets cold in Scotland. It snows in Scotland. I know that for a fact. So,
That's so kind. Thank you.
Yeah, you send me your address. We'll ship you a Bunsen toque.
Oh, my God. Oh, I love that. Thank you so much.
This was, I didn't know which way this conversation would go when you mentioned about hats. And I'm just so glad we had it. Hopefully it resonates with some of our listeners. And maybe there's some people out there that thinking that they're alone and they're maybe not so much.
Yep. I was going to talk about Lord of the Rings at this part, but I'm glad that got ahead. We have some else.
Dakmar, you also wanted to talk about Lord of the Rings?
Yes. Always.
Okay.
I think this got brought up earlier with the fish names as well, because I think when I told my supervisors I'd named some of the fish after Lord of the Rings characters, they looked at me a bit weirdly. But no, I think just this kind of plays into the mental health stuff I just mentioned as well, because, I'm an adult. Sometimes people think, oh, adults should be serious. They shouldn't be so involved with like kids things. And then they think Lord of the Rings is like a kids thing, but I love it. And it has been a very big source of comfort during my PhD as well, like a bit of escapism, just getting into like this fantasy world where PhDs don't exist, archer fish don't exist. I love my fish. Sometimes I don't want to think about them. Not just Lord of the Rings, but other fantasy media as well. Recently getting into Dungeons and Dragons, which it's just really, really good to have something that can take you out of your head and put you really in like a completely different a setting and location. And that's always been a passion of mine. So if it wasn't a scientist, I would want to do something that has something to do with Lord of the Rings. I don't know what that would be, but that's what I would want to do.
I love it. I am a Lord of the Rings nut as well.
Yes, very good.
I love Lord of the Rings. I don't know if you've seen the picture, but I have a replica Gandalf the Grey costume.
I don't think I've seen that one. I've seen your other like cosplay that you've done, and it's so amazing with the dogs.
I've got the and his sword. I've got the replica Glamdrung sword.
Oh my God!
And then I dressed Bunsen up as Frodo, and we had a picture with him and me. And he's Frodo, and instead of the ring hanging off of his neck, it's hanging off of his snoot. I'll see if I can find it and send it to you. It's an adorable picture.
Oh, please do. That sounds so cute.
I trained him to wear a big, like a hobbit wig, right? So he's a dog with the great big, like hobbit hair.
Oh my God. That's incredible.
Cute. And I sometimes, I'm trying to think the last time I wore my Gandalf the Grey for Halloween. I love wearing it at school because I go from classroom to classroom telling kids, you shall not pass, just to freak them out. Especially if they're writing it. No, I'm just kidding. I tell them that if they're writing a test, like if you did not study, you shall not pass. And
that's fair. Yeah. That's just realistic. If you just go around yelling at kids that they're not going to pass, that would be a bit cruel.
One more Lord of the Rings question for you. Do you have a favorite character from Lord of the Rings? It's a tough one.
I think it would have to be Faramir.
Oh, very. That's just, common. That's a really deep answer too.
I mean, I think he was J.R.R. Tolkien's favorite character too. But I think I just have like a weakness for characters that try so hard and no one appreciates them. and he's he's amazing. I just think as a character.
He resisted the ring's evil, right?
He did. Yes. And despite how disappointed Denethor was in him, he still, you know, tried his very best for Gondor and almost gave his life. And then in the end, he gets to be happy, which is also very nice.
Yeah. Well, I think we can just all agree that Denethor was a great big a-hole.
Oh my God. The real villain. The way he ate that the way he eats that tomato in the movie is very bad.
I hate the tomato part too.
It's so bad.
But it makes him so like. Oh God! I don't know what they were thinking. They're like, "Can you eat this tomato so everybody hates you?"
Yes.
And then the actor did it, and it was
it's
like
fantastic. But I can't watch that scene, honestly.
Another guest I had. She's a geologist. She named her cat Faramir too. So.
Oh, very good. I named a Twitter friend of mine. His cat had four kittens, and I got him to name them Frodo, Merry, Pippin, and Sam.
That's great.
They live in Minnesota. I've never met these cats, but I named them.
Guaranteed the Pippin one is just like useless and out of control. Yeah. So
my grandma's dog's name is also Pippin, and he's very sweet. But that's about it.
That's about it. Yeah. Okay, I'll have to move on from this. Like, I talked about Lord of the Rings. I think I talked about Lord of the Rings with the other guests, and I had to cut about 10 minutes. So.
Oh my God. Yeah, we can stop. I don't want to make your editing more difficult.
It's all good. We're at the end of the interview, mm-hmm. Dagmar. I've just been smiling from ear to ear. It's hard in an audio cast to get the visual, but I think people have found that this has been just so educational and so fun. Can people follow you on social media? Do you have accounts you'd like to plug?
Yeah. So I'm currently in the midst of starting a YouTube channel and I'm going to have a website soon, but nothing's set up. So at the moment, you can find me on Twitter. That is at DJ Veduwen, which is spelled W-E-D-U-W-E-N. I do fun fish facts at 5 p.m. on Fridays. I post photos of myself wearing hats. and you'll find any information about my future YouTube channel where I'll do little segments about like fish adaptations and how they're actually way smarter than we might think they are. And you'll find all that information on my Twitter in the near future.
Okay, we'll make sure that we have a hyperlink in the show notes so people can just click on that and it'll take them right
fantastic.
To your Twitter account.
Yeah, that's great.
It is my pleasure to have talked to you today. Thank you so much for agreeing
so
to give up
fun.
Your time.
It's been so much fun.
Yay.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
It's time for Woo or Wow on the Science Podcast. It's been a bit of a thing. We're trying to do this live on Spaces, on Twitter Spaces. We have Hoseline, who's been helping me weekly with Spaces. He's going to be the guest host for the trivia section. How are you doing today, Hoseline?
I am doing very well. I'm excited.
That's good. One of the questions we asked just at the start of Woo or Wow is just a little bit about the person. Where are you in the world, Hoseline? I believe, are you on the East Coast?
I'm on the East Coast, Boston, Massachusetts, and indeed.
What's your day job besides helping out intrepid adventurers like me in Spaces? Or is that, like, what's your day job?
It's essentially that. I run an agency that helps brands best leverage social media marketing. So and now expanded to help creators do the same type of thing. So
yeah. Well, I mean, you've really helped us with Spaces. I wouldn't have known what I was doing without your help. So
yes, sharing is caring, my friend.
All right, so you've been roped into being the guest on Woo or Wow. Woo or Wow works this way. I read three statements. Two of them are fake, so they're woo. Two of the statements are going to be false. One of the statements is going to be true. It's the wow. So, Hoseline, you have to wait till I read all three and then figure out what the true statement is.
Okay.
It's like two truths and a lie. Maybe you've played that before.
Yes.
Right.
I love it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, there's no prize except for the pride of winning. And if you don't get it, that's okay, because rarely would I win these without the facts in front of me. So don't worry. It's all for fun.
Okay.
State and the category this week is about fish. So the category this week is about fish. Do you do any fishing, Hoseline?
I did when I was like in eighth grade. And I caught like 15 fish. It was like one of those where you just drop the line on the side of the boat and it's like, it's not really fishing.
No. But it's still something. All right. Yes. Here we go. Statement number one. Fish do not have any taste buds. Okay. Statement two. Fish in the Antarctic survive the cold because of thick layers of fat that surround their body. And statement three. A fish brain is tiny compared to the size of a bird's brain of the same size. Like, if the bird and the fish were the same size, the fish brain would be tiny compared to the bird brain.
Those are the three statements.
Antarctic fat fish.
Yep. You think that one's you think that one's woo or wow?
That one is the true. That was the wow one.
You think that's the true one? Okay, final answer.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. All right. So the did you have a feeling about the first one being false, the fish taste buds one?
Yeah. It seems kind of weird.
Okay. Right. So you are correct. That is one of the woos. Fish do have taste buds. In fact, some species of fish have way more taste buds than us. The catfish has 27,000 taste buds compared to you and me having around 9,000. So fish do have taste buds. I don't know what they're using it for, but obviously tasting things in the water. All right, so we're down to two statements. Let's see if you guessed correctly. Do you want to hear about the Antarctic fish first or the fish brain?
The brain.
The brain? Okay. A fish brain, as the statement, as I read, a fish brain is tiny compared to a bird brain of the same size. It's about 1/15 the size. Is that true? If it is, you've lost. But if it's not true, you win, right? Because you thought the second statement was true. That statement is, that's the true statement. Fish brains are tiny compared to bird brains of the same size. Yeah, they're about 1/15 the size. That's true. 0.06% of the mass. So fish have a very small brain compared to birds, which actually have a larger size brain for their size. So that means the second statement isn't true. You'd think that it would be the fat that surrounds their body, but it's actually the proteins in their blood that acts like an antifreeze. They have like this really cool system that keeps them from freezing, and they can live permanently less than 1 degree Celsius, so super cold water.
Wow.
I don't know if I'd like to swim in the Antarctic. I think we wouldn't last very far. I would probably like a whole suit of blubber around me rather than special proteins in my body.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and that's what I was thinking. But the brain stuff definitely makes a lot more sense now.
Yeah, we've owned fish before, and they're kind of dumb. Not going to lie.
All right. The whole goldfish thing, right? It's like they last for 3 seconds, I think, which is a fallacy, but it...
Yeah, they can remember a little bit more than that, but it's not like a bird, right? We're learning more and more about crows, and crows are on the upper echelon, like corvids. They are highly intelligent.
Yeah, they attack when crows attack.
That's right.
But it's funny. They're not smart enough to deal with the scarecrow, so there we go.
I guess so. Well, you know what? Thanks for letting me rope you into We're Wild this week, Joseline.
No, this was fantastic. I look forward to at least being a listener in the future scenario.
Okay, it's time for story time with me, Adam. If you don't know what story time is, story time is when we talk about stories that have happened within the past 1 or 2 weeks. I will start. So last night, Beaker was acting really weird. She was being really barky and looking out the window. And no one really knew what was happening. Bunsen for sure didn't know what was happening, so he just started barking too without knowing what she was doing.
That's because he's blind.
He is blind. But what happened was, Beaker was looking out the window and she saw a critter. Something. I don't know what it was. It might have been an owl. It might have been a coyote. But it was something. And Beaker saw it, and she had her eyes locked on it, and she just started barking. And she barked for a long time at it, and then I went, and I was like, what are you doing, Beaker? And then she was like eagle eye glaring at something. She said, oh man, why would you do that? And Bunsen was barking too, and I'm like, what are you guys barking at? And then she looked away, and then she couldn't find it again. So that's the Beaker last night, was just barking with Bunsen. Like, just continuously. There was no end to it. And then I came upstairs and then talked to her, and then she lost it. And then you guys went outside, and then an owl screeched at you.
Yeah, the angry owl.
The angry owl in the tree. Mom, do you have a story?
I sure do. So there has been a pattern of events. There has been a pattern that has continued, and it's been happening enough that I think it's time to discuss it. So Jason is an early riser. And he likes to get up with the dogs and make his breakfast and then make coffee and then give the dogs breakfast. And he likes that. I, on the other hand, am not an early riser. I do enjoy my sleep. However, you know, I am a go-getter, so I do get up in the morning. But what has been happening lately is Jason will be up, Beaker will be up, Bunsen will be up, coffee will be on, They all have had breakfast, and Bunsen comes in, and he is now my new alarm clock. What are you doing? Why aren't you awake? Bark, bark, bark. He barks at me, and he says, come with, come with. And if I don't go, then he'll come back. Bark, bark, bark. Where are you? Why aren't you here? Yeah.
I love it. It's my favorite.
Well, I love it too because I love him.
He's a good boy.
He's a good boy. Second part to my story is today. There's two parts. The second part to my story today is that it's the first day back for teachers. It's called the Teacher Organizational Day. And both Jason and I had to go in to work. Now, although I'm teaching from home this year, we got to meet in person, socially distanced. I teach with a smaller staff. So this was planned. Anyway, so now Bunsen is outside. Beaker is outside, going to the bathroom, kind of the last minute. Like, let's get everything ready before we have to go. Bunsen knows something is up. He's like, she's in a dress. She smells like flowers because I put a little bit of perfume on today. He was on high alert. And Jason went outside and then said, you'll never guess what Bunsen did. And I said, what? He said, he was sitting by the van waiting for you to let him in. And that just makes me so sad because he leaves paw prints on my heart, and I really missed him today, but I came home for lunch, but I just love him so much. He's my little buddy. And
he's not so little.
He's not so little. He's my buddy. He's my Bunsen. He's my Bunsen bear. He's my puppy. That is my story.
All right, little tidbit. When Bunsen is eating like his Kongs, he puts his hand around it like a bear. He holds it like a bear, and then he just starts going, and then that's how he eats his Kongs. All right, Dad, do you have a story?
I warned Chris that Burners pick a person, and Bunsen has picked Chris. So we'll see how much she enjoys that when it's minus 30.
Woohoo! I'm game.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right. My story...
I just need a survival suit.
You need a survival suit.
Yeah.
Okay. That's how they say it in France and Quebec.
Suit?
Survival suit.
No, that sounds like bird...
Suit? No, suit. Survival suit.
Survival suit.
Survival... I can't do it, but Adam can because he can speak French. Anyways, my story is about obedience training with Beaker. So she's in obedience training and she did so good. We're so proud of her. She was a little barky for a couple times. Like she saw the other dogs and was barking at them. But man, she is so smart. Adam's mentioned this a bunch of times that she's so smart. The other dogs were like struggling to do some of the things and Beaker's just like, I had her doing speed cues while the other dogs were like learning to lay down. And Beaker was like, up, down, stand, up, down, stand. And that's with Chris packing her normal dog kibble, which she's kind of meh about eating as treats. So I was pretty impressed with her. I'm excited to keep taking her to obedience training. It's really fun. And it's good for dogs to get that with distractions. So that's my story.
Well, okay, to add on to that, Zool did come out. Yeah. Zool came out a couple times, like, ooh, 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 like her Zool sound.
She was growling and barking a bit. Yeah, but some of the other dogs were barking the whole time.
Yeah. And a couple of them just got off their mat and was like running to the center, but Beaker didn't. She was like, what?
And that's story time. Hope to see you guys down the next podcast for story time or fingers crossed mailbag.
Oh, yeah, we should do mailbag.
Yeah. For those of you who are new, you might figure out what mailbag is next time because we haven't done it in so long. That's the end of my section. Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's show. Special thanks to our expert guest this week, Dagmar Derve-Duven, who talked to us about the amazing Archerfish and as well Lord of the Rings. I'd also like to give a special shout out to our top tier patrons on Patreon. Without their support, we wouldn't be able to do what we do, and it keeps growing. It gives me warm fuzzies how much our patron family has grown. So take it away, Chris.
Samantha Dodd, Kimberly Bond, Nate Stevenson, Debbie Anderson, Courtney Proven, Renee Hardy, Mary Rader, Shelby Leggett, Dan Bry, Mary Coos, Katla Lynch, Marianne McNally, Andrea Persons, Elizabeth Bourgeois, Karen Beth St. George, Bianca Hyde, Lynn Armstrong, Lisa Swartz, Catherine Jordan, Donna Craig, Lila Ashier, Jody Ogren, Liz Button, Kathy Zerker, and Ben Rathert.
Let's close with the dog's motto for science, empathy, and cuteness.